KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. New York was an interesting place in the 70s. The big blackout, Son of Sam, and of course it was a decade that James Walcott made his trek from Baltimore to New York City. All his adventures in New York in the 70s are detailed in his brand new memoir, Looking Out, My Life Getting Down and Semi-Dirty in 70s New York. Jim Walcott is here. He's back. Jim, thanks for being back here.
Thank you for having me.
And that's the thing. You really basically are almost like Christopher Isherwood in New York in the 70s.
Well,
not entirely.
he had a different set of activities in Berlin and all, but
you can't look at the book and not think about New York as being like Weimar Republic Berlin.
Well, I'll tell you, Isherwood really is one of my favorite writers. Particularly those earlier books, because I love the fact that you're aware that he's seeing these things and he's there, but he isn't intruding that much into it. You know, I wouldn't say it's self-effacing. But, you know, well, the famous line, I am a camera eye, you know, and I like the kind of – there's a coolness to his writing that I like, because for one thing, then it lets – if the reader's going to feel emotion, the reader feels it. Like a lot of writers, it's like, here's the moment I'm going to have you feel the emotion. Like in movies, when all of a sudden like the music cues you, like, oh, a sad part is coming, you know, the resolution is coming, you know. No, it was a spectacle, the way that Isherwood wrote about it.
Well, and I thought about Isherwood. I ended up just looking at I Am a Camera again just before I reread the book, because I thought about that thing that he does that connotes both excitement and non-judgment. Mm-hmm. You know, just sort of like, I can't believe I'm here, a little bit of it, and almost sort of standing back. And I see that a lot in the way the book is written too.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, a lot of the scenes, you know, if people were to see them now, the sort of things that went on, they'd be much more likely to be judgmental, or much more likely like, well, I disapprove of the way that they blah, blah, blah. And you couldn't be that way at CBGB's, you know, because for one thing, you just didn't know what was happening or, you know, what was going to happen. So the idea that, you know, you had to have this instant judgment slapped on it, you know, that's something like I try not to practice even now, because even now, I mean, people are much more likely now to like all of a sudden have a filter and like, this is acceptable, this isn't acceptable. You know, a lot of it is sort of like you're seeing things that are weird, but you realize, well, to me it's weird, but of course to these other people, this is totally normal.
The funny thing too about the book is how often death intrudes, and it's just matter of fact to most people in New York and the series. In the very beginning of the book, you talk about going to stay at the hotel and this woman sitting next to this guy who just basically passed away, and she goes, oh, he was so lively yesterday.
Oh, yeah. I didn't put this in a book, but I remembered later there was an incident in that same hotel where I was going to the elevator, and a woman in the hallway, like in a muumuu, said, did you hear the screams last night? It sounded like somebody died up there. And of course I hadn't, you know, but I'm oblivious to everything at night, but you know, and the thing was, that was kind of like a common thing. You know, you see people slumped on the streets, and you didn't know, did they overdose? Did they not overdose? Were they sleeping? Were they, you know? So, no, it was a much more common thing.
It's The Treatment. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. My guest is my friend Jim Walcott, who, of course, is a contributor at Vanity Fair, but has written in places from Village Voice to Harper's to The New Yorker. His new book about his life in New York in the 70s is Looking Out, My Life Getting Down and Semi-Dirty in 70s New York. One of the things that I also found fascinating about the book, too, is that you tend to be attracted to people who are writers living their lives the way they want to write about, or people who created the narrative for themselves. And that goes from Mailer to Pauline Kael to Gore Vidal, but also to that punk scene in the 70s where these people had a really writerly aspect, like Patti Smith and Tom Verlaine. I mean, that's a fascinating aspect of the book, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there was much more crossover. And there was also much more sense of like of a writer being a dramatic presence. You know, like Norman Mailer was very much into that, you know, his TV appearances. I mean, it's clear that if a writer is invited on, say, David Letterman, they are there to serve Letterman. They are not there to take over. you know, Mailer would come on and take over. And not only would, you know, he take over, but of course, these shows were done in New York. And like, they'd be yelling back and forth to the audience. You know, you'd see Mailer yelling up to people in the balcony and they're yelling back and being booed. And, you know, and now if like somebody gets booed, they get really upset. They're really hurt. Mailer's like, he's like feeding off of it. Like, you know, you want to boo me? Well, all right. You know, but they would have, you know, critics on talk shows. This was a time when Rex Reed and John Simon were on shows all the time attacking other critics. Or see, now no one would even think like, oh, let's put a critic in the front row to challenge. Can you imagine, like, and Scarlett Johansson, here's what someone thought of your latest movie. She'd like, stop tape. Like, you know, like, where's my agent? Writers were much more dramatic presences.
But the thing, though, that sense of adventure that writers are looking for in creating a narrative for themselves is something that you really trained an eye on.
Well, because it was something that was so much in the air. And it was like in the air not only at the highest level, but at like – you know, at places like the Village Voice, I mean, a lot of the writers there truly were characters. You know, they were well known on the scene, you know, such as she died fairly recently, Jill Johnson, who was like, you can't really call her a dance writer. She was one of the very first lesbian activists, but she was political in a way that was just different from everybody. I mean, totally undoctrinaire. But Jill was very much like a character. You know, there were others who were just, you know, writers thought of themselves more as characters. I also sometimes wonder if part of that was the connection with alcohol, that, you know, is like there was something about, you know, people drank at places like the Lion's Head or later Elaine's, and of course they had in their minds the models of Hemingway and then later Mailer, and they began to think of themselves like, well, I'm a hard drinking, you know, I'm there on the scene. No, I mean, clearly Pete Hamill thought of him. You know, Pete Hamill was a character. So it was very much in the air. I mean, now it's weird how writers now, and maybe it's the creative writings world, they're much more recessive, like, oh, I really shouldn't put myself personally forward, you know. I mean, there's like a two-tier system. There are the writers who think they're too good for that, and then there are ones who are like, you know, friend me on Facebook, please. Well, I've only got 40 friends.
Well, that's the thing that's so attractive and so much fun about the book is you pick these people who weren't out to ingratiate, who didn't want to make friends, but also were creating a myth around themselves.
Part of it was I was drawn to them, but, you know, in the case of Pauline, she picked me. I mean, it was like, you know, Pauline called up. But, I mean, clearly Pauline saw a kindred spirit, you know, and as we know, Pauline liked to have allies. I mean, she felt embattled all the time. And she liked having people around. She liked that cushion of people around her at screenings, you know, to kind of deflect some of the dirty looks.
Well, my guest who's getting no dirty looks for his new book is James Walcott, cultural critic for many places. He's now at Vanity Fair. His new book is Lucking Out, My Life Getting Down and Semi-Dirty in 70s New York. And you just seem to be in the front row for so many of these things. And there's a passage in the book where you spent a lot of time at CBGB's as it was basically kind of the Mount Olympus for these new gods, as Jack Kirby would call them, who were creating themselves. And there's a section in the book that I asked you to read where you talk about Patti Smith.
Okay. The first paragraph is from my review of Patti in The Village Voice. So would it be too awful to say that fame is her steed if Patti Smith chooses to mount? Well, the horse might be the perfect emblem for her career. Quote, I ride the stallion through the dust storm is the way she begins a poem entitled Mustang. Get off your Mustang, Sally, is what the women told her at the piss factory. But Patti didn't listen. Patti said screw it. And skinny, skizzy Patti is on her way to becoming the wild Mustang of American rock. Okay, true, granted, I slapped a lot of mustard on that fastball, especially in the last sentence. Skizzy was a pure Paulinism. But it was the last great hurrah period of rock crit, tell it from the mountain epiphanies, and few of us were immune. Only a year earlier, a pop critic high on the totem pole named John Lando had pronounced, I saw the rock and roll future and its name is Bruce Springsteen. Arise ye faithful! And when Springsteen, with Landau now serving as his record producer and horse whisperer, went on to make the covers of Time and Newsweek the same week, an unprecedented coup, I muttered to myself at the newsstand, I have seen the future of rock, and now we're stuck with him. It wasn't that I disliked Springsteen. How could you dislike a scrappy car mechanic of a singer-songwriter-showman so driven, enthusiastic, passionate, embracing, and earnest? It'd be like ragging on Thanksgiving. But it was his very earnestness, his eager-to-serve sincerity, that dulled the tips of my nerves, even when I was riveted by one of his legendary performances at Da Bottom Line in 1975, the stint that has lived on in the annals of Bruciana. I remember checking myself during one of his big rousers with the question, "This is incredibly exciting, so why am I not excited?"
But that sense of just evoking myth, mm-hmm. part of the excitement that you feel in the book. I mean, mm-hmm. you really are there to explain it.
Well, and you know, a lot of it isn't in retrospect. I mean, even at the time, people are going, "These performances are amazing." You know, particularly the Bottom Line. I mean, the Bottom Line entered it immediately, and then it has become like the, you know, one of the landmarks of the Bruce career, but also rock in the 70s. And, you know, this is something I learned from Albert Goldman. You know, Albert Goldman, you know, who everyone came to hate because of his Elvis books and
John Lennon book.
You know, he said, "There's no substitute for being there." You know, he said, "You could read about all these things and, you know, you can do your research." He said, "But there's no substitute for actually being in the room and seeing it happen, because you pick up a gestalt that you're not going to get secondhand."
Which is also something you got from Pauline, too. She was a big advocate for being there, not just at movies either.
Mm-hmm. No, Pauline, and again, I think this is a big difference between Pauline and critics today. I mean, most of the critics today who are movie critics, that's all they are, and they become these sort of rabid completists. It's like, "Well, I'm a little disappointed with the new Blu-ray edition. They own like four editions of certain movies, and you know they own like the all foreign region version and the American version, and you know, and they feel like, for example, with festivals that you have to see everything, even if you're, you know, the most minor thing, you know, because part of it is bragging rights." But Pauline really felt, you know, she had a background before she, you know, really got her New Yorker job, but Pauline was very much into theater. She had a range of interests in that, and also art, and it fed into what she did. Now, with movie critics, the only thing that feeds into their movie writing is other movies. That's all they have.
Well, what people now call intertextualization is one of these things she's at the forefront of doing.
There was that, and also one of the things about Pauline was she really caught the social currents, I mean, the social turns in the air and how they were reflected in movies. Whereas now, we're like, our environment is such a media environment that everything in the movies is a reflection of something else happening in the media for the most part. But like Pauline, like, she would talk about how one of the reasons people are drawn to even a terrible movie like Looking for Mr. Goodbar is because people are interested in how other people are doing, how they're making it on the single scene, you know, what's happening in those bars. So a movie that takes you in there, like, it feeds an interest, a personal interest, a sexual interest. I mean, apparently her desire to write about Deep Throat wasn't just about porn, but the idea of, like, the movies have been where people get their erotic notions and their romantic notions. So what does it say that now, you know, we've gone from whatever, you know, the romancers, you know, and MGM films to Deep Throat. But of course, I mean, the New Yorker was never going to run that. But no, she was caught up very much like the currents in the air.
Well, and on that romantic note, we'll take a break. My guest is James Walcott, cultural critic. His new memoir, his new book is Lucking Out, My Life Getting Down and Dirty, Semi-Dirty in 70s New York. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
I'm Jenny Rattlett, producer of The Treatment. If you like our show, you might also like The Business, KCRW's show about the business of show business, hosted by Kim Masters of The Hollywood Reporter. Find it on iTunes or on KCRW's smartphone apps.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. My guest, James Walcott, has written on books, he's written on movies, he's written on television. Now he's writing on himself in his book, Lucking Out, My Life Getting Down and Semi-Dirty in 70s New York. Talking about television, I mean, the thing that we were talking about before the break, a kind of excitement about seeing something as it was happening, television had never been accorded that kind of currency before you started writing about it in The Voice.
Even when people wrote about television, they did it with a certain kind of elevated detachment, like, oh, here I am in front of this television set, and here is this program that I am reviewing. However, don't think that I am enmeshed in this system. You know, there was almost like a clinical aspect to it. And I try to write about television in a way that people actually like watched it, you know, that, you know, you had your favorites that you got obsessive about. And then there were others that you watched for totally silly, superfluous reasons. Like there was one cute actress in them. So like, well, I'll give this a few episodes. But one of the things I did, I realize now, is like in a way, the television column at Du Bois was in some many ways like almost like a pre-blog, in that sometimes I would do two or three different shows. I would just kind of throw things together, or I'd have like a running gag or a running theme, rather than doing like this is a formal review of this TV show. Because TV was it was something that you followed week after week.
And one of the things you did and that was made you unique in that aspect is that you wrote about performances on television, which people didn't tend to do. I remember you writing about Kate Nelligan and Thérèse Raquin.
There was a lot of really interesting acting being done on television. I mean, I remember seeing movies with actors like, you know, Deborah Raffin, was that her name?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, and she was actually like very good at a couple of made-for-TV movies. I remember Lauren Hutton being very good in a kind of psycho thriller that was on TV then. I gave Kim Basinger in a otherwise like negligible made-for-TV movie, but I gave her like one of her first very favorable reviews. I could see that there was something really fresh about her on screen. I was also countering myself against, at the time, the New Yorker's TV critic who wrote very, very infrequently was Michael Arlen. And he always did big think pieces. You know, they were kind of big, what does this mean? How does this relate to the larger, you know, gestalt of society? And what does it say about us as a people? You know, I never like it. What does it say about us as a people? And he almost never wrote about performances or particular shows, you know, just like what made them work. I mean, it was much more interesting to figure out, like, why does a show like The Rockford Files work? You know, I mean, these things were distinctive.
And you talk about Clive James in the book. And you also talk about that flight to seeing Pauline being kind of a white knuckler.
Oh, yeah. No, we're like bouncing up and down. It was a little prop plane. And as we're like pulling in to Massachusetts, into the Berkshires, there's like a little hill around the airstrip, and there are all these people sitting on the hill looking up. And I said, well, what are they doing? And he said, waiting for us to crash.
I'm bouncing up and down with my guest, James Walcott. His memoir is Looking Out, My Life Getting Down and Semi-Dirty in 70s New York. It's an extraordinary piece of writing. I guess that the thing that I've always loved about your work so much is just that your complete immersion and just opening yourself up to your impulses in that way that some of these people that you connected with, like Lester Bangs, it was just at a lot of points just like a raw dangling nerve.
Lester was a really funny experience in a sense.
He was like an extraordinary rock critic in those days where rock criticism actually shaped people who got signed by record labels.
The thing that did put me off a little bit about Lester was Lester was good in small doses. The thing about him was he was somebody who had a lot of shtick, a lot of routines, and there were people who would encourage him to do them, like, you know, like they would just like prompt him, hey, Lester, what do you think of the new blah, 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 you know, Olivia Newton-John or whatever. And he would like do his riffs, you know. And at a certain point, you realize you didn't need to be there. I mean, you were not, you know, he was not interested in a real conversation. I mean, most, you know, sometimes he was, but a lot of times he was just on and he was just sort of broadcasting. And
being almost combative for combative's sake.
Oh, yeah. Taking totally perverse positions. Not even for the sake of being contrarian. I mean, it was almost like he was trying to find a comic routine he could, you know, work into it. And sometimes it would work in print, but, you know, he couldn't do it. But the other thing was like, I didn't understand the repetition thing. And I mentioned in the book, there were times when like Lester would call me and then he would start something and he would repeat himself exactly as he had the previous conversation. And I thought maybe it was a put on. And I still don't know what it was. It was almost like some part of his brain checked out and he just went into autopilot. But he was, you know, it's sad because he was a tremendously talented writer. And it was one of those things where he really was turning his life around. He had really gotten off the worst of the drugs, But he was in that sort of weakened state after some people like get up, give up their worst stuff. But they're feeling better, so they actually think that they're stronger than they are.
As you mentioned in the book, when he was in basically recovery, his mm-hmm. body hadn't itself recovered from all the years of abuse.
Yeah.
He just had one more relapse that finished him off.
And, you know, it was very sad. I mean, I remember – and I talk about it in the book. I remember seeing the CBGBs. You know, because, you know, Lester was somebody who like The Village Voice did a whole article about basically – what a funky character he was. I mean, physically, like he didn't, you know, the hygiene was not the best and the clothes he wore, he would just wear the same things. And he did like an article and like people said, Lester, you shouldn't have like let them use you this way, even as like a joke, you know. And but then when I, you know, towards the end, like I saw him and he had like completely cleaned up and he was like, you know, very well dressed, hair trimmed, et cetera. And, you know, it was actually rather sweet. I mean, you felt like, okay, he's like in, he's transitioning to whatever the next phase of his life and career is. And then, you know, the phone call, at first people thought it might have been a suicide, but I ruled that out immediately because I just knew that, you know, I just knew his morale was actually better than it had been before.
It's the truth. I'm talking to Jim Walcott, an extraordinary cultural critic who has written a terrific new book. The book is Lucking Out, My Life Getting Down and Semi-Dirty in 70s New York. There is this incredible sort of sense of momentum about that New York, even though there was death everywhere. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned in the very end of the book being in the cab with Pauline Kael the night that John Lennon was shot.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also this enormous sense of momentum in all that. Were you aware of that kind of downhill motion that the city had when you were living in it?
I was aware of it. You didn't quite know where things were going to go. And I think one thing that nobody could have predicted was the way the turnaround would happen and what the turnaround would look like. I mean, there's a sense of like when people have a sense of entropy and things are in decline, they can never actually imagine that, in fact, you may be hitting bottom and on the way, you know, on the way up, because there are no visible signs of it. So there was no way of knowing in the 70s, like, oh, we're going to enter the era of Donald Trump and fashion where women are wearing these gigantic shoulder pads and, you know, almost like Versailles gowns as we get into the 80s. I mean, you couldn't have predicted that. But what you could see that there was just like a lot of dynamism. There was on a lot of different fronts. And so you were aware of that and you did feel like that the grit and the friction in the air contributed to that. That if everything got nicer, it's, you know, and more antiseptic, it wouldn't be a good thing for it. But at that time, you couldn't imagine it was ever going to get glossy and antiseptic. It was like it just seemed, you know, impossible. I mean, people, I think, are really sometimes shocked when they look at documentaries or films shot in New York during the 70s, and they see that the subway cars, the windows were completely painted over, so that once you got in a car, you really felt trapped because the graffiti covered the windows. And sometimes you had to wait until the doors opened. You could see what stop you were at because there was no way to see through the windows. I mean, and it was like you walked into a subway car. You didn't know what was going to happen, you know, what was going on.
That's why I brought up issue with the beginning, because there's mm-hmm. just that sense he talks about 30s Berlin. It's almost like playing roulette every day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing that I get from the book.
Yeah. Well, you know, I say it in the book, you develop a situational awareness that I have even now. I mean, you would walk around and there was a much more sense, not just of crime, but of just craziness. Because there were mental patients were being unloaded from the hospitals. There was a lot more kind of just craziness in the air. And the aggression was just much more out front. You know, now we're in, of course, the great era of passive aggression. So it's like, you know, it's much more likely people to say, you know, like little minor things. Like, you know, I won't use the language, but this was like one of my telltale incidents in New York. It really like taught me something was my first year in New York. There was some guy on the corner. Like, he looked like a blue-collar guy. He was like eating a sandwich or something. And somebody walked by and this real cheerful voice said, "You really seem to be enjoying that sandwich." And the guy turned and said, "What the blank is it of yours whether I'm enjoying it or not? Why the blank can't I chew my food in peace? Who the blank do you think you are? What, you want me to come by your place?" And I thought, right then I thought, I learned a lesson, like, you don't go around volunteering comments to New Yorkers who, you know, and the thing was, I sort of saw the angry guy's point, like, what, I need your commentary?
There's also a section in the book you talk about one of your teachers coming to visit you and making a mention about in the East Village, right outside Hell's Angels headquarters.
Oh, yeah. We were in a cab going together, And the cab pulls up and there's a red light. And this was Hell's Angels headquarters where all sorts of terrible things went on. I mean, and, you know, they were kind of a law unto themselves. And there was a Hell's Angel sitting out on a stoop, you know, in his vest. And my teacher said, God, get a load of that fat slob. And it was the summer, the windows were open, and like there was like this freeze. And I don't know if the guy heard it, but you felt like a little, like he picked up something, and he like looked at us, and we were like sitting there like, don't say anything, don't move, look blank. And then, you know, finally the light changed, and the driver turned around, and driver said to my teacher, he said, don't ever do anything like that again. You know, because the thing is, they would have pulled you out of the cab. I mean, it would have happened.
Oh, so and, that blocks oh, the third between first and second was the law unto itself.
I remember I was in the Village Voice when the Hells Angels were upset about a piece written about them, I think by Howard Blum, and about six of them came in and went to the elevator, and the receptionist said, excuse me, do you have an appointment? And it was clear like – it was clear the Hell's Angels were not terribly concerned. They didn't have a social secretary that set up appointments for them.
They would stop by to get the badge and say, hello, my name
is. Oh, no, they didn't. And the thing was, I'm not even sure they knew what floor they were going to. They were just going to find someone to talk to.
Well, the thing I really got most from the book is that page by page, section by section, New York slowly makes its way into your bloodstream. And by the end of it, you're no longer a Baltimore boy. Is that how it feels looking back now?
Yeah, although I think I sort of adjusted to New York right
you
away.
Adjusted.
But yeah, it takes a while to like you lose. And in fact, the funny thing is, around the time of the punk period, I went down to Maryland for like Thanksgiving or something. I went to this local rowdy bar, and there were things going on there that shocked me more than CBGBs. But there was no art connected with it. It was just kind of like, oh, here's a drunk girl. I hope she does. You know, it's like dancing on the, you know, and like basically falling off and nearly killing herself. And I thought, you know, it's a funny thing that like even at CBGB's, that wouldn't happen. They wouldn't have been encouraging someone to make a drunken spectacle of themselves unless they were like on stage doing it for their art. Oh, yeah. No. Oh, no. And I'm sure that I probably got like by the end of the, I'm sure I was insufferable whenever I got to be like, oh, well, you know, well, up in New York, we don't do that. No, Yeah.
Well, your new book is for everyone. My guest is James Walcott. His new book is Lucking Out, My Life Getting Down and Semi-Dirty in 70s New York. It's a terrific book. I'm so glad you're here. I've been doing this show for 15 years. It's always a treat to have you come by, Jim.
It's always a kick to be
Okay. Our recording engineer at Argo Studios in New York is Paul Ruiz. The associate producer is Jenny Rattler. The show is mixed and edited by J.C. Swadek. Oh, my God. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's the treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on the Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.